I'm Adrian Johns. I'm a professor in the history department here at the University of Chicago, and I also chair a graduate program called Conceptual and Historical Studies of Science, which looks at how the sciences, medicine, and technology have interacted with society over very long periods of time, as well as very short periods of time. I'm going to be moderating this panel where we have four speakers to talk about the society part of the technology and society interaction. I came in towards the end of the last session, and something that Mr. D'Agostino said reminded me of something, a story that I was told about 6 months ago. My father-in-law happens to be, or was, before he retired, the head of computer sciences at the University of Michigan, and he's, in the common with many computer scientist people, something of a kind of nerd. He told me that he got into a conversation with somebody about the dangers and opportunities of artificial intelligence and robotics. And this person was convinced that robotics couldn't possibly be a social problem in the future because of the laws of robotics, which made it necessary that no robot could ever harm a human being, and no robot by inaction could ever allow a human being to come to harm, and so forth. In other words, this person really thought that robotics, artificial intelligence, technologies in general, have natural laws to which they cleave, and we can rely on those to keep us safe as we go forward. Mr. D'Agostino referred to the issues about thinking falsely, thinking badly about the nature of laws when it comes to technology, and this seems to be an example of that. We know that technologies don't necessarily obey these kinds of natural laws, that the interaction between the social good, and for that matter, the social ill, and technological systems is something that has to be much more actively engaged with. Every aspect of our lives is going to be affected by that kind of engagement, not just our jobs, our financial well-being, the decisions we make about our investments, what it is to be creative, what it is to play a part in the cultural and social political systems of our age and future ages. And I hope that our diverse panel today will help us think through some of these issues. I'm going to not introduce them all at the beginning, but introduce them one by one seriatim. And each one will speak for about 15 minutes. We'll then have a moderated Q&A between the panel with me involved, and then throw it open to the floor. Our first speaker is Scott Commoners, who is a junior fellow at the Society of Fellows at Harvard University and was an inaugural research scholar at the Becker Friedman Institute for Research and Economics here at the University of Chicago. His education was all at the H Word in Cambridge. He has AB in mathematics, an MA in business economics, a PhD in business economics, all from Harvard. And here at the Becker Friedman, he's working as co-leader of the Human Capital and Economic Opportunity Group, which is focusing on issues of inequality, on how you measure, interpret, and guide and devise policies to address inequality. And he's today going to talk on the future of economic design.
Thank you very much for the wonderful introduction. Thank you all for being here, and to the Chicago Society for having me here. It's a tremendous honor to be invited back to a place where you once taught to come back and say more things. It suggests that people actually still want to hear you. And I hope I will not wear out my welcome with this talk. I'm going to talk today about what I'm calling the future of economic design, in particular how technology will shape the use of economics to build and rebuild markets. This is in some sense a concept talk. I'm mostly going to say things about changes and shifts and new options to try and put questions and ideas into your heads. And I will unfortunately provide very few answers, although I will tell you a few things about what answers might look like. Now, many of you have probably gone through at least one course in which they've given you some attempt at explanation of how you should give talks. I've been through many of them. And I usually ignore all of the advice. For example, I've by now clearly ruled out the don't spend a full minute discussing the meta theory of how you organize the talk. But the one I always try and stick to is you should always start a talk with a question you know how to answer. So if I'm mostly going to be asking questions, it's a little bit hard to define a natural question that I myself already know the answer to. However, here, I can actually ask a very sort of fundamental definitional one. What do we mean by the term economic design? This term isn't even really codified within economics yet. We'd normally say something like market design. So what are we talking about today? Economic design is about translating economic principles and analysis into practical solutions to real-world problems. And all of those words matter. It's translational. It's about taking fundamental ideas from economics and using them to actually make things happen in the world. Some of those might be real-world policies. Others might be, you know, very low-level things like writing the code that is used to, say, assign students to their schools. Several of my colleagues have done this in the city of Boston, in the city of New York. You know, the public schools are matched through economics. And I'll try and clarify what I mean by ideas like that. And economic principles and analysis, we're really trying to use both the tools and the theories of economics. So we're going to take theorems and superimpose them onto reality. We're going to have ideas about how people respond to incentives, how they process markets. And there are going to be market mechanisms that are broken or in some fashion non-functional. There might be market failures, places where there should be a fully functional market, but for one reason or another, there's not. And the question is, can we change the equilibrium? Can we use ideas from economics to help us understand a fix and then eventually implement one? Practical solutions. We can't stop with theory. I realize this is a little bit blasphemous to say in a UChicago pulpit, but we are going to push all the way to practice. So, a couple of examples just to set the stage. First of all, the national residency match. So some of the students in the room, or some of the alumni in the room, some of the students in the room will one day go to medical school with exceedingly high probability. With also quite high probability, at least one of the alumni in this room has also been to medical school. Well, between medical school and being a fully certified practicing doctor, you go to residency. And the assignment of doctors to residencies used to be extremely chaotic. We're talking early 20th century. Offers would get made earlier and earlier and earlier every year. And if you get an offer from your second choice hospital, that might look really good. You go out and have a party on the first day, but you know, on day seven, when the offer is about to explode, you would say, gosh, I'd really better take this thing. I don't know if I'll ever hear from my first choice. And then 4 days later, your first choice calls you. And you say one of two things. Either you say, oh, I'm really sorry, I just took an offer for my second choice hospital. Or you say, that sounds great. And you call your second choice and say, sorry, it turns out my spouse can't stand the city of Boston. Therefore, I'm not coming. And both of these scenarios caused problems. Eventually, these offers moved so early that doctors were accepting residency offers in their second years of medical school. And this was eventually replaced with a centralized system. You know, sort of everyone agreed that the offers shouldn't be that early, but it's equilibrium. Conditional on when everyone's making their offers, you want to make yours earlier. This was centralized with a very magical algorithm that produces an outcome in which, you know, sort of it's stable. Nobody has an incentive to try and renegotiate their contracts. And even more, the doctors are incentivized to reveal their true preferences over jobs. And so here, the incentives, in some sense, for the doctors are made very similar. They're simple. They reveal their true preferences, they go into the centralized system, and it assigns matches. I'm not responsible for the branding. The system actually works pretty well, but I don't know who at the National Resident Matching Program thought he's met his match is the right brand. But in practice, this is a very effective, well-functioning labor market. A second one, which I'll give about 20 seconds, not for a reason of import, but just because it's purely a second illustration here, we now use centralized mechanisms to do what's called paired kidney donation. So if you have a kidney donor, or if you need a kidney donation, you might have a willing donor, but who cannot donate to you because of a blood type or tissue type incompatibility. We now use centralized exchanges to match potential donor-patient pairs. So there's someone else out there with an also personally incompatible donor, but who's compatible with you, and that person, you know, can work with your donor. But now, so I promised something about technological change. So far, I've only told you about economic design. First of all, as technology changes the need for economic design, just the pure demand, you know, this is a demand side effect, changes tremendously. So what's a major technological change we've faced in recent years? Apparently, a lot of people have been using smartphones. Anyone? Smartphones? Yeah, just a couple in this room. So smartphones keep using more and more bandwidth. So it starts, people are like, oh, I've got a BlackBerry, I can send email. Now what do we do with smartphones? We watch YouTube videos. We might be filming this talk and then emailing it to people. All sorts of very, very high bandwidth uses, but who has a lot of the airwaves? It's not, you know, well, the smartphone companies, you know, or the phone companies and telecoms have a lot of it, but not as much as we'd like them to have. A lot of the airwaves are stuck in contracts with television broadcasters. So I just did a survey on smartphones. How many people here have watched broadcast television in the last month? So this is about the population distribution. It's not very popular. People have cable or they're watching on their phones. And so what we'd like to do is consolidate the airwaves somehow. We'd like to take some of the broadcast television channels and take those wireless bands back and use them for phone applications. But this is actually very hard. The broadcasters own these airwaves, and we don't know how much they're worth. We don't even know sort of how much to pay those broadcasters. And so this has led to a very impressive system of what's a double auction, where we're simultaneously running a forward auction to sell the package and a reverse auction to buy the package from the broadcasters to try and make sure that nobody gets expropriated. Everyone gets the full value of their band if they're one of the ones who ends up selling. And this has been an incredible multi-year endeavor. It's been done mostly by a team at Stanford led by Paul Milgram. But it's just an incredible exercise of auction design, and not to mention with some really deep computational problems underlying it. Second, in the same vein, even before this, it became necessary to have lots of shared space for wireless. So like when we have our wireless routers and modems at home, those are sharing airwaves that don't belong to any telecom, but that somehow need to not interfere with each other. And the mechanisms of wireless spectrum sharing have also been, an incredible source for new design and new thinking among economists and computer scientists. But now, so I want to take us even further. We've seen that sort of a demand-side story, but technology also shifts sort of our ability to work on the structure of markets. It also creates new tools. So one market that's sort of historically been very, very difficult to do any sort of real tracking and monitoring of is world fisheries. So how does fish farming, or not fish farming, but sort of big ocean fishing work? Well, different countries have different permits. There are sort of defined regions where you're allowed to fish. There are rules. You're only allowed to take a certain number out. They're monitored very carefully. If you go over your permits, you're fined. But in practice, there's a huge amount of poaching. And why is there a huge amount of poaching? Well, it's really hard to detect. And so we, if you call in the economists or whomever else you're going to have try and design your fishery preservation policy, I guess you'd call in fisheries scientists, which actually there's a whole fisheries economics branch inside of fisheries science. It's very hard to think about how you just stop poaching a priori because you don't know how to tax people for it. But very recently, it's gotten much easier to detect. So this is a recent paper, 2012, It was pointed out to me by a UChicago undergraduate whom I worked with while I was here at the Becker Friedman Institute. And it turns out Google Earth satellite imagery is now so good that we can see individual fishing areas from space. And so suddenly we have an entire new instrument for monitoring. If we want to actually calibrate our permit system correctly, maybe we should be piping our rules. We should actually tighten the quotas, make them more accurate towards our real targets. Loosen the quotas, but make them more tightly approximate our actual fishing targets, and then add in a component like satellite monitoring. The types of rules we think we can enforce will change tremendously. And as we heard in the last panel and in the panels before, there are all sorts of dangers, right? There's complicated privacy rules and issues when we start trying to do monitoring based on the technology people are carrying around. Nobody wants this place to become a surveillance state. But simultaneously, we should think about these as policy levers and understand where the boundaries. This is all sort of completely public, and these guys are, doing something that is literally visible to satellites in the outside world. We should think about whether we're comfortable having these types of technologies at our disposal in trying to clean up the market. So now we've been in space, I want to take you into your pocket. So the logo for the Technology and Society Conference contains these smartphone things. They keep coming up. Well, these would give us an interesting possibility that we could actually sort of stick an economist in your pocket. So we have all these, classical economics has this rational actor model. We've in recent years found all of these unusual behavioral biases from them, some of which we think are sort of real estimations of preferences, but some of them, like self-control problems or inattention or imperfect memory, inability in this case to remember exactly what's happened over a long period of time, these seem like things that people might actually want to fix. And you see a huge market growing for apps that help remind you of things or help you remember, languages you once spoke but haven't spoken in a long time. And so similarly, you might imagine that we could have a series of economist apps, things that help you do the sorts of tracking and optimization that you yourself might one day want to do. And here, there's no specific market interaction. There's no market design, but rather we're doing economic design. We're helping to design the way people themselves interact as economic agents. And this, I have to cite a paper because it's sort of an idea that I haven't seen in practice anywhere, although these guys Drew Fudenberg and Alex Pesakovich show one interesting example with regards to showing people recaps. So essentially, if people fail to understand their, fail to pay clear attention to their credit histories, if you show them and have, underpayment and sort of adverse effects, if you show them recaps, sort of aggregate information about what they've been doing, rather than complete histories, they fix their behavior much faster. And so you can imagine apps that help people, sort of in their daily, life, track recaps. How many meetings have you missed? How well are you doing at your meeting your own behavioral standards? And of course, while we're working on your smartphone, of course, one of the largest markets worldwide is also in your pocket, right? So this app store, here I guess I have the iPhone app store, the Apple store, but there are also, there's analogs for Android and so forth. These guys have over a million, I guess 1.3, 1.4 million was the 2014 estimate for the size of these stores that are allowing all sorts of people to engage in a market transaction they never could have imagined before. They're programming at home. They've maybe got some data off this Chicago Open Data Portal, and they're trying to do something with it, and suddenly they can bring it to market in a way that we'd never imagined. And then these apps allow us to create new types of markets as well. So, many of us have used Lyft and Uber as a cheaper and more user-friendly alternative to taxis. Perhaps fewer have used Tinder and Hinge, but I'm sure there's been at least one offender somewhere in the room. Also, incidentally, I don't know about their branding choices, but these are the sort of official pictures that Tinder and Hinge use to advertise themselves. And then finally, in the last minute and a half, I want to say the technological change is actually enabling everyone here to work on the design and construction of markets and to help out sort of make the world more robust. And there are a whole bunch of examples of this. I'm going to put it, be totally silly and put in a plug for one that I've been working on with some collaborators. So through the Driven Data Portal, which is a platform that runs civic-minded data competitions, we've been doing, one project, nothing on the scale of what, Brett and Ian talked about earlier, but one project to try and understand the city of Boston's hygiene ratings. So we have all this data from Yelp, which Yelp has graciously contributed through Luther Lowe and Soups Ranjan. And you and anyone else are invited to participate in a market competition. You're going to try and come up with the best way of predicting which restaurants will be inspected. And the winners, receive prizes and glory and will hopefully be able to include the solution in the actual practical workings of the city of Boston. So, to wrap, economic design. Hopefully I've convinced you today that we can now translate economic principles and analysis into practical solutions to real-world problems. It has a past and ongoing work. These medical match and kidney exchange applications have been, real successes of the field. In present, the spectrum reassembly thing is happening this year. All sorts of exciting work with predictive cities. Dating remains a very entertaining place to work on markets. And I hope in the future we can put economics in your pocket. QED.
So our next speaker is Marcus Jean-Simon. Marcus is vice president of goals-based consulting at Merrill Lynch. He got a BA in business administration from Loyola University here in Chicago. And he works out of concepts of behavioral finance, trying to design investment strategies that are more closely aligned with the desires and objectives of particular investors and less to, I guess, the older, more systematic models of economics. He's going to talk to us today on how goals-based wealth management, utilizing soft and hard data combined, leads to better investment decisions.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I haven't been on the campus of Chicago since I was 14. My mother was a nurse here for 30 years before she retired, so it's nice to be back in the all wooden halls of Chicago. So back when I was a kid, I always dreamed of working for an industry that was really had a strong, really had a strong reputation for trustworthiness and doing the best thing for their customers. And then I decided to go completely left and join financial services. So with that said, we have a problem, right? Our problem is, how do we balance what's best for the investor versus what's best for the investor that he or she can actually adhere to? And the difference between those two concepts really is the perspective in which the investor is going into said strategy and or investment. And The main driving factor as to why we're taking such a good look at this as a firm is the fact that if you look at the average equity returns of the market versus that of the average investor from 1992 to 2011, this is a Dow Bar study that we did, there's a gap, a significant gap. So the question is, what's causing the gap? Anyone venture to guess? So the gap, you suggest, is a function of investors not looking at historical returns and making
of indices,
right? Any other guesses? Yes.
Lacking diversity.
Yep. Yes. That's a good point. We'll touch on that, right? The other thing that I get a lot of is fees. It must be those Merrill brokers who are charging you too much, and that's the reason why the gap is there. This is net of fee, just to let you know. But to your point, it's really all about cyclical markets, right? And the only thing that's consistent about the market, as we know, is that the market is going to change, right? There will be peaks, there will be troughs, and what we need to understand is, why do us as human beings go in and invest at absolutely the worst time? Every single time, right? So if you look at this, you'll see that as markets are doing very well, as they are right now, right, there's a sense of euphoria. And that is actually the worst time to throw your money into the market. But the market is doing so well, you're watching CNBC, everyone's saying everything's phenomenal, your 401k statement is up, your balances are up, you can't lose. So you throw money in, and then what happens, right? The inevitable happens. Markets will decline, right, subsequently. And then at the point where the markets are at a low, like, say, March 2009, we're depressed, the balances are down, we're like, I can't stomach to lose anything more. Yank me out, put me into cash. And that's actually the best time to put money in, right? So this phenomenon is really what we're trying to study at the firm, is try to understand the human perspective to investing and trying to sort of crack the code as to how do we build the right strategy that allows an investor to adhere to it, right? And how do we figure that out? It's easier said than done. But just to kind of give you some perspective as far as some of the issues we face. Would anyone here argue with the fact that these are two identical lines? Anyone? Okay, good. You perceive them as two. It's almost as though you saw this already, right? But look at this. Now, which one is longer? This seems overwhelmingly basic, but those two additional lines gives the perspective of it being longer, which indeed it is not, right? Another example. Let's say you bought stock in a company that's worth $6,000. The company goes bankrupt. You have options, okay? Option A, you get $2,000 back. Option B, have a 1/3 chance of recovering the entire $6,000 and a 2/3 chance of recovering nothing. Which one would you take? I kind of gave you the answer here. 92% of the time, we take A. Why? What would you take A? Loss aversion, it's a sure thing, right? But then when we provide the same scenario to an investor, just in a different way, the exact same output, the exact same outcome, but just framed in terms of loss versus recovery, the answers change. Right? This is critically important. And this is really the crux of why that gap exists between what the markets can perform over a long period of time versus what individual investors actually get credited with in their accounts. So what do? We say we got to be serious about understanding our clients on a deeper level. We need to understand the fact that there's a human element to investing, and we have to operationalize the understanding of that human element and put it into what it is that we do each and every day when we recommend things to our clients and when we make recommendations to our investors. So how do we do that? How do we create a method in which we could, number one, have an engaging way of interacting with our clients so that when we ask them questions, they actually answer, right? Number two, how do we get accurate responses from them? And number three, how do we put those into practice in a fashion that's not completely laborious and cost ineffective? So we created what we call an investment personality assessment. It sounds kind of corny, and it kind of is corny, but it helps us understand a much deeper level of our clients. So through this assessment, we're trying to understand more deeply what's their mindset when it comes to risk. So very different from what's your risk tolerance or your appetite for risk. If I ask you, do you like risk? Who's going to say yes? Unless you're just one of those daredevils who like to jump out of airplanes and stuff like that, right? But when it comes to their money, most people don't like the idea of taking on undue risk. But what we're trying to understand is more than just what your risk appetite is. What we're trying to understand is when you find yourself in a position of risk, what is your reaction? Is your reaction such that you will go to cash and lose the opportunity to actually rebound in the markets? Is your reaction a loss of appetite, a loss of sleep, or a loss of hair? Right? All three of those are very, very distinctly different reactions, and we're trying to predict what a client's reaction might be by way of this assessment so that we can build a better solution on the front end rather than reacting to it after the fact. We'll look at one's investment approach. So we want to understand what sorts of things, what elements of investing do you tend to gravitate towards? Do you like the idea of your money being tied up and illiquid? Do you like the idea of having your principal protected? How involved do you want to be in the day-to-day management of your accounts? So that helps us understand what solutions are best, and furthermore, will help us better prepare that solution for the client. The other part is, what's your purpose for investing? Are you investing primarily for yourself, for your family, or for your community? For those clients who have philanthropic aspirations. And what we found is that based upon that purpose, you'll have a very different risk appetite. So here are the nine personality traits that we try to decipher for each and every client. The confidence, their adaptability, and their experience. So what does that mean? So confidence in the markets. What that basically means is, how confident are you that investing is the right thing for you to do? Just initially, before we get anywhere else, is investing, do you feel good about investing? Number two, the volatility. This goes back to the example I gave you of how well you're able to, how well are you able to stomach the volatility in the markets. And then experience. This is proclaimed level of experience. I've come across investors who have been investing for 40 years who feel as though they have very little experience. I've come across investors who have been investing for 6 months who feel that they are the Oracle of Omaha. Right? So this is a self-proclaimed number. What does this tell us? This tells us exactly how arrogant are you in your ability to manage your own assets. Either rightfully arrogant or wrongfully arrogant, we just want to understand. That understanding helps us in building that solution for you. Am I down to 5 minutes? Wow, I'm having fun, it's fine. So investment approach. As I mentioned before, we're talking about accessibility, protection, and activity. How accessible do you want your funds to be? how much are you interested in protection of your principal, and also how involved you want to be by way of your activity. And then purpose, we talked about self, family, and community. So now we get into the aspect of we can figure out each client's investment personality and then superimpose upon that qualitative data, the quantitative stuff that we've been doing for decades, right? So we can build portfolios and build strategies for clients with blinders on in silos and just say, based upon all the computer, all the computations, based upon historical returns, here's the best portfolio for you. But then if that portfolio is not one in which the investor can actually adhere to or stomach, then it's not the best one for them. So this is why it's important for us to understand the qualitative aspects of their mindset, superimpose that upon the quantitative, and come up with a solution that makes the most sense, and therefore minimizing that gap that we talked about on the previous slide. Now here's the real kicker here. What happens when husband and wife who have the same portfolio have different personalities? We see this time and time again. That is an interesting conversation, right? Preferably had over a bottle of wine. But talk about group decisions. How do we make group decisions? Anyone find themselves in a situation like this? All those in favor say aye. Everyone says aye because everybody else is saying aye, but no one believes in what the person is saying. Hopefully that's not happening right now, right? What about this? Well, heck, if all you smart cookies agree, who am I to dissent? Anyone find themselves in a situation like this? Right? And then the almighty, I'd like your honest, unbiased, and possibly career-ending opinion on something. May I proceed? At your own peril, of course, go ahead. So we find these dynamics between husband and wife to be very, very counterproductive in deciding what's the best solution to use moving forward. And we're intent on understanding exactly everyone's mindset individually and coupling that even between the husband and wife to be able to help build the right solution moving forward. Those, the differences between is not just between couples. As you can see here, this actually shows you what percentage of couples typically have what amount of varying elements. So we have 9 elements of investment personality. 25% of couples have 5 or more elements that are out of whack. Like I said, interesting conversation, wine, right? So in many times, part of my role is to help support these conversations with our clients and help navigate through the differences of investment personality, differences in mindset, and come to a consensus, so to speak, of what's the best route to take moving forward. But it's not just between husband and wife. A lot of times we have some varying consensus around between parents and their children. So there is, I believe the most recent estimate was there's about $40 trillion of inheritance coming to the baby boomer generation. And they're anticipating twice that for a generation Y, which are those individuals between 18 and 35. I just fall outside that category, unfortunately. With that being said, generation Y investors are more likely, they gravitate more towards tangible assets and not the stock market. So how do you navigate that conversation? How do you navigate that disparity in personality between those that are passing on assets versus those that are inheriting assets? It's a problem, and we're intent on figuring it out. And so far, we've been doing pretty good. All right. That is all for me. I'm over time.
I think it's actually kind of reassuring that I've spent all of my life in the academic world and I've never really been involved in finance, and so I'm aware that people have very different perspectives on what the questions of technology are and what the really hard problems are, but it's kind of reassuring that I would work through representations of technology in society by, you know, heavy German philosophers and heavy historians, and I would get to the point that really what solves it is wine. And it seems nice that we've independently confirmed that this is actually the case. Anyway, our next speaker is Trevor Pinch. Trevor is one of the founding figures of the new enterprise of science and technology studies that evolved in the United States, the UK and France and various other places in the 1970s, 80s and 90s, and is now a mainstay of interdisciplinary approaches to science and technology in the modern world. He has a PhD from Bath University and has for a long time now taught at Cornell, where he's the Goldwin Smith Professor of Science and Technology Studies and the Professor of Sociology. He has a great slew of publications to his credit. I guess one series that I'll point to is a series of accessible guides to how to think about science, technology, and medicine in the modern world, which are called The Golem, The Golem at Large, etc., various other sorts of golem. He's also a pioneer of what's becoming called sound studies in the United States, having written Analog Days, The Invention and Impact of the Moog Synthesizer, is that how it's pronounced? Excellent. The Moog Synthesizer, a canonical instrument of the late 60s and early 1970s. And he is himself a member of a band called the Electric Golem.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and be introduced by my good friend, Professor Adrian Johns, fellow Brit as well, I've detected. I'd like to thank you for the invitation and for the students for organizing this conference. It's really nice to be here at a student-organized conference. I took the theme, technology and society, maybe a bit literally, because I actually teach a class on technology and society. So I figured I would frame my talk around thinking a bit about the relationship between technology and society. So that's what I'm going to do, but I can't stay away from the Moog synthesizer. And by the way, it's interesting in terms of the pronunciation. In Britain, we always used to call it Moog, and I thought it was a made-up name for the sound of the synthesizer, Moog, but there actually is a Dr. Moog, and he used to have a little sign on his desk, Moog rhymes with rogue, not Moog rhymes with fugue, so he really cared about the pronunciation. So if you learn one thing today, it's going to be the pronunciation of that word. I'm going to play just one little piece of music if we can get the technology to work as well. So let's go cracking. So two big thinkers on technology and society have already been introduced in this conference. Karl Marx, who's a very important thinker here, who talks about dead labor in machines. He's making a very important point that we often think about machines and technological artifacts as separate from the wider society. He's saying, no, you should think of the two together. Martin Heidegger's name was mentioned as well. And in that famous article on questions of technology, he contrasts somebody making a pot in ancient Greece, a chalice perhaps, as a process of poesis, more akin to poetry, bringing forth into the world, versus modern technology, which is enframing us. Again, technology and society connected. Now, a lot of work shows how technology influences society. That direction is fairly easy to establish. I have here a slide. They make this technology from a startup at Cornell, many of them. This is a silent disco. I don't know how many of you have been to a silent disco. They're good fun. And the latest trend in this, apparently, this is where you have, you know, the sound comes in through Wi-Fi. You can all dance with your friends, but there's no sound in the room. The latest trend in this apparently is to have two different sorts of dance track going at the same time. So this is really funny because you have different rhythms in the room. But I mean, this is an obvious sort of, we talked about the smartphone is a great example, but many, many examples of the bicycle earlier. But I mean, this is an obvious thing where the impact of technology on society, there's a way of dancing and a technology comes along with Wi-Fi, headphones and so on. And then it changes the environment of this socially organized activity of society, this little society of dancers. And it's silent if you overhear this. It's much harder to do the other thing, though. And this is what I spent a large part of my career when we were developing this new field of technology studies, we were thinking about this issue, about then how does society influence technology? Because there you're often counteracting a very strong discourse from engineers who think technological artifacts have to be designed the way they are because of engineering and physics principles. Now, that's certainly part of the story, but it's not the whole story. So I want to talk mainly today a little bit about how the society gets into the technology using the Moog synthesizer as the example. And there's a late Bob Moog, died in 2005. He invented his synthesizer, in the electronic music synthesizer, in the period 1964 to 1970. The reason I've written a book about him is he happens to be a Cornell engineering physics student, had his factory just outside of Ithaca, upstate New York. And when I arrived there, I used to build synthesizers in London in the early 1970s and play them. I had an abortive career for 1 year in a psychedelic rock band. It was enormous fun, but an academic career loomed instead, and I ended up being an academic. So when I discovered Robert Moog, who had been at my own university, this is a great chance, very rare in your career, and I recommend young people to do this, where you could combine a passion with an actual intellectual interest, which was writing about the development of this particular technology. And if you know anything about synthesizers, Moog was a kind of a cult hero, but he's got a lot of wider credence since. Just towards the end of his career, people start to realize this is actually a big deal, this whole invention of a new musical instrument by Robert Moog. In 2002, he won something called a technical Grammy, and he won it with Stephen Jobs, Jobs got it for the Apple computer. So this is really turning out to be a big deal, and just to remind you of this is one way, this doesn't always indicate a big deal, but whoops, sorry, we've gone, can we go back? I'm, of course, like everyone who talks on technology, incompetent with it. Yeah, so this is one marker. This is the Google Doodle, which is the, you'll find these things online for the Mini Moog synthesizer. You actually make a little bit of music that emulates the Mini Moog synthesizer and record it there. So towards the end of his life, he was starting to get this sort of recognition. Now, the bigger question I like to think about here, and why he's getting this recognition, this is an interesting question in terms of thinking about invention is an innovation, is why do new musical instruments come along so infrequently? If you look back for the 20th century, you have the electronic music synthesizer. It's a whole new class of instruments. You can go in any music store in the world and buy a synthesizer. They're made today mainly by Japanese multinational companies, Korg, Roland, Yamaha. You may have messed with a Casio synthesizer, or your kids may have messed with one. You can still buy Moog. But it's a new invention. It's sold in retail music stores. You have to go back, and let's do this. Let's go back. Oh, this is popcorn. Oh, let's just listen to the sound. This is the sound of the Moog synthesizer. Let's just do this now. Does anybody recognize this track? Okay, that was originally done by a group called Hot Butter. The composer of that was Gershon Kingsley. I've interviewed Gershon Kingsley, and he's really sad that he's remembered for this track. He's kind of a serious composer. He told me all about this Yiddish opera he'd worked on, and this is the thing he's going to be remembered for, because it's used in a lot. You probably heard it as a Nike advertisement it's been used for. But if you go back through the history of musical instruments, you have the electric guitar, Les Paul, 1940. You have to go back to the saxophone developed by Adolf Sax in 1840, which he designed for marching bands, but only became popular in the 1930s with jazz. And there's a clue, actually, to the success of musical instruments, that you need a kind of new genre of music to take off with the instrument. So there are very, very few of them. One of the leading salesmen I interviewed, a Moog salesman, told me this. He said, imagine the violin had never been invented, and you go in a retail music store, and there's no repertoire, no one knows what a violin is, and you try and sell a violin in a music store. Now, we know musicians are incredibly finicky. Many of you here are musicians, have bought a musical instrument. You have to touch it and feel it and play it. It's not something you just buy from looking at a picture of it. You want to get hold of a musical instrument. The aesthetics of it are important. Now, imagine you go into a musical instrument store with this violin. Maybe you can play it. No one, you give it to the guy who owns the store, he's not going to be able to play it. It's going to make a weird sound. And he'll say, you want to sell this thing? What's that horsehair thing you're rubbing on it? That cat gut. It would be very, very hard. And so this is part of the story of the difficulty of innovating in the area of musical instruments, actually getting into music stores and persuading people to actually sell the instruments there. And the Mini Moog, developed by Moog in 1970, is one of those few instruments that successfully got into music stores. So I'm treating here, by the way, I passed over a slide back there, that musical instruments can be thought of as pieces of technology. So that's my example. And Moog wrote in the foreword of my book that you can think of a musical instrument as one of the most sensitive pieces of technology we humans have developed. And so, you know, they're mass-produced. Think of mass production of pianos. They're essentially pieces of technology. So that's the whole approach that I kind of use for thinking about the history of musical instruments, to thinking of them in terms of the history of technology and the sociology of technology. So there's the Mini Moog, comes out in 1970. So that's a key instrument, and this is the way forward. It's still an analog instrument. The circuitry is analog, but it's an instrument that you can make sound charts for. You can start to stabilize the sound on this instrument and reproduce acoustic instruments for the first time. It's a monophonic instrument. It's an affordable instrument just to rock bands at the time in the 1970s. And there was a new move of music taking place then, something called progressive rock, which is very important in this history. It followed on from psychedelic rock with bands like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Yes, a performer called Rick Wakeman would use this instrument. So what I do in my work is you follow the instruments. So this would be things like the places where they're found. The different uses is really important, and they're used early on for ads. Moog's second ever customer wanted to use the Moog synthesizer for making advertisements for coffee percolating for Maxwell House called, his name was Eric Sade, and he made $40,000 just for one little ad for coffee percolating for a coffee percolator using the Moog synthesizer. And so you follow the users as well of these instruments. Now, here's the question I ask in my book, and I want us to think about today. Why do synthesizers have piano-like keyboards? They don't have to have piano-like keyboards. There was another engineer, Don Buchlar, working on the West Coast exactly the same time as Bob Moog. He's been influenced by the avant-garde experimentalist tradition, particularly John Cage. And he says, we have this new source of sound, electronics. Why be stymied by this old interface that comes from pianos and harpsichords? Let's be much more imaginative. So he designed wands and touch plates for his instruments. He was trying to get away from the whole idea of this 12 semitones of the conventional scale. Moog attached a keyboard to his instruments. You can ask the same question, why do computers have QWERTY keyboards? It's exactly the same question. There's a lot of work on this. Why is it that this old typewriter interface comes over to your computer? We've already talked about this at this conference, one of the earlier talks, that control of technology is one of the really crucial issues. And we have very, very few interfaces between humans and these machines that we've developed. And this is very well illustrated for the history of computers and for the history of synthesizers as well. Here's a picture of Robert Moog in his studio in Trumansburg. That's him there with the pen protector. You can always tell him he's a 50 years engineer with the pen protector there. And I showed Bob, I do most of my work by interviewing, we call it ethnography, hanging out with these musicians and engineers. And I asked him, why the keyboards? And he says, the keyboards are always there. Whenever someone wanted to take a picture, for some reason or other, it looks good if you're playing a keyboard. People could understand that then you're making music, you know. Without it, you could be tuning in Russia. So he's getting at a very, very simple point about how society gets inside technology, our particular image of technology and way of interacting with technology. People, although it's a monophonic keyboard, a note at a time, people are familiar with it, with keyboards representing musical instruments, and they can interact with the machine much more than they could with Buchla's wands and strange plates. And this, it sounds silly, but this turns out to be a key thing, because then we have standardization of instruments, and he standardizes his instrument around this whole technology of the keyboard. He has the technology of the day, something called voltage control. A volt input will produce an octave change in a key thing in a synthesizer known as an oscillator. So he's standardizing around a particular concept of music, that music has to be in octaves. It doesn't have to be that way. According to people like John Cage, it could be very different, the experimental tradition. So this is how society is getting embedded into the technology, and that's the point I want to stress. Culture and society gets embedded into the hardware of technology and then gets carried forward, the same way that the technique from learning to type that women used to do in typing schools led to the stabilization of the QWERTY keyboard gets embedded into your modern laptop or your smartphone with the QWERTY keyboard today. And that's a key thing, I think, about the relationship between technology and society to think about. How does society get in? If you're an innovator, how do you do this? Moog was really onto this. You look at the people who are going to use your technology. You follow the users, basically. And he did this in a very simple way. He was up in Ithaca, New York. If you've ever been to Ithaca, we're centrally isolated in the middle of nowhere, about 5 hours from anywhere you want to go. Most of his customers were down in New York City. And what he'd do is he'd ride the Greyhound bus down to New York City, take a synthesizer with him, and deliver it to his customers. And these were very expensive instruments in the early days, the price of a small house. And he'd watch how they used the instrument, and he'd adapt the instrument according to how they were using it. So he was learning from the users. He'd bring them to his studio, and he employed studio musicians. He didn't do this according to a Harvard Business School plan. This is how Bob described it. He said, all the people I did business with in the early days, they remained collaborators and friends and customers throughout the years. They've been very valuable to me, both as personal friendships and as guidance in refining synthesizer components. So this is how society is. It's quite straightforward in a way. He talks and interacts with the users of the technology, adapts the technology to them. The users have particular ways they want to use the technology. You can think of the users, if you want to think of it this way, as kind of being in the society. This is how they get incorporated into the black box of the technology. So users, if you like to think of it like this, are the conduits of society. So this is one way that society gets into technology. I just have to mention this, because this is kind of a key technology in terms of the psychedelic 60s. And some of the earliest users of the Moog synthesizer were really cool bands of the day, The Doors, The Birds, and The Beatles. So there's a picture there of Paul McCartney using it on Abbey Road, four tracks of Abbey Road. We had time, I could play you that. We could get into the whole Abbey Road. It was used by a band called Tonto's Expanding Headband there on the right with the biggest ever synthesizer in the world. Sometimes play tracks from that. It's like being in an airplane. The guys from Tonto were absolutely crucial because Stevie Wonder, who has the best ears in the business, heard the psychedelic sounds they were making and wanted them on his own records, and his breakthrough records came through in the 1970s. He used the sound of the Moog synthesizer. So one more slide just to wrap up. This tradition continues of the synthesizer through another classic album who used the British synthesizer called VCS3, the Pink Floyd for Dark Side of the Moon. So the synthesizer is influencing stuff in the technology, the sort of music we're getting, but also the society and culture and music at the time is influencing the development of this technology. And it's always that way, this relationship between technology and society. So it's wrong to separate them off from each other, I think. And I'll end there. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So our fourth speaker is Chad Syverson, who is the J. Baum Harris Professor of Economics here at the Booth School of Business. Has a PhD from the University of Maryland and BA and BS in Economics and Mechanical Engineering from the University of North Dakota. He researches the interactions between firm structure, market structure, and productivity in today's world. And he's going to talk to us today about technology, productivity, and employment.
Thank you very much. I've been on panels before with folks who have talked about market design. I've been on panels before with folks who have talked about behavioral finance, but I've never been on a panel with someone who talked about the Moog synthesizer. So this is a wonderful and exciting first, and more generally, it's a real pleasure to come talk about this topic with you today. So we hear endlessly about the new technologies that are here, the new technologies that are coming, the way they've changed the world, the way that they will change the world. Smartphones, I checked that box. You got to have smartphones on a slide in this conference. Social networks, social media, the robots in Amazon's warehouses, fulfillment centers, biotechnology, autonomous vehicles, driverless cars, drones, just some examples. Okay. We've all heard the stories. Now, there are many wonderful aspects of these technologies. They have great potential in many ways, but at the same time, a lot of them have raised concerns about employment and what is going to happen to people when these technologies are employed to produce the things that we make. In short, this is summarized by the robots are coming for our jobs concern. And I'm going to speak to that a little bit today. And many economists, when someone says that to them, give a set of kind of standard answers. Okay? And I'll talk about those. Usually the first thing is, well, look, we've had new technologies created in the past, and we've always found jobs for those who were displaced. In 1850, roughly 80% of the labor force were farmers. Okay? Now it's 1%. We figured out something to do with those other 79% in the meantime. We don't have a bunch of unemployed farmers walking around the fields of the Great Plains. Another point is, well, look, let's suppose the robots are making everything. Well, we're going to have a lot of stuff, and they can make it probably very cheaply. So we're going to be rich. So, okay, people aren't working, but we're rich, not working people. It's time to start cultivating grapevines for wine or something like that. Or a related argument is, look, robots will be cheap enough that almost anyone can own them. It's not that a few rich people are going to own the robots and make everything. Anyone will be able to get a robot. Everyone can make their own stuff. Or a corollary to that is, at least things will be priced low enough that almost everybody, or everyone, or almost everyone can afford to buy them. Okay? So those are the usual answers economists give to the robots are coming for our jobs concern. But that's a little too quick, a little too easy. There is precedent for having some concern, at least in the short run. And here, when I say the short run, I mean a couple decades, and not a couple months. So, for example, think about U.S. manufacturing since 1960. Okay? Manufacturing employment now, it's a few million workers less than it was in 1960. So in 1960 is maybe 18, 19 million. Now we're talking 13, 14 million. Okay? What's happened is, if you look at the patterns of that changes in overall drop in employment, the brunt of it, more than the brunt of it, was taken by workers with less than high school education. And that was for the first 30 years. And then starting in about 1980, 1985, people even with high school degrees started experiencing disemployment in manufacturing as well. At the same time, folks with college degrees actually, there are more people now with college degrees working in the manufacturing sector than there were 50 years ago, quite a few more, even though there's millions of fewer people with lower education levels. So if you're a certain kind of worker in 1960, 1970, 1980, there's reason to be concerned about automation in manufacturing. You were going to lose your job because of that. Okay? Now, that's something that, you know, again, maybe over the course of several more decades, that works itself out, just like we've worked out what to do with the 79% of people who aren't farming anymore. But we've had 170 years to do that. Okay? For a few decades, at least, there was some transition that had to be dealt with. Another example is the so-called hollowing out problem. So this comes from very nice work by David Otter. He's a labor economist at MIT and his co-author, David Dorn's first name. They showed that changes in employment, they showed this picture. Now, what does this picture show? It shows the employment growth rates of various occupations as a function of that occupation's skill level, as measured by the occupation's average wage in 1980. And you see a U-shape. So what does that mean? It means the jobs that grew the most between 1980 and today are those either at the high end of the skill distribution, okay, the college-educated workers, or the very bottom of the skill distribution. It's the middle that's been suffering in a relative sense and sometimes in an absolute sense. And again, these are patterns over 30 years. So these kind of long-term, and I'll say further, they've shown that some of these patterns are tied to technology replacing middle-skilled jobs, right exactly where the bottom of the U is. So again, technology seems to have had real employment effects in this case. Okay, so that's the lay of the land in terms of the argument. Now, I've had As a title on all these slides I've been talking about so far, a paradox, but I haven't told you what the paradox is yet. Okay, the paradox is, for all this discussion about technology and how the world is changing and what it's going to do, productivity growth, which is our main measure of technological progress, has actually been slower than usual for the last 10 years. And we don't know why. Okay, so let me show you the numbers. So the sort of golden era of productivity growth was the post-war period, 25 years after World War II. Average labor productivity growth was 2.8% a year. In other words, output per employee was growing 2.8% a year. Okay, and why is this important? By the way, all economic growth in the long run comes from productivity growth. That is not an opinion, that is a fact. That's just accounting. Okay, so when productivity growth slows down, that means we're not going to be getting wealthy at the same rate we were before. We're not going to have as many resources to solve the problems we face as we were before. Okay, so we had the golden age of productivity growth, and something happened in the mid-1970s, and it fell almost in half, 1.5%, and went on for 20 years. And actually, there came a point around 1990, mid-80s, 1990, people were saying, "What? I see computers everywhere." Bob Solow famously had a quote, "I see computers everywhere, but not in the productivity statistics. We have half as fast productivity growth as we did in the post-war period." And then in 1995, something happened and it sped up again. And people said, finally, the computers are here. We're getting the productivity growth we always expected from. Unfortunately, that only lasted about 8 or 9 years. And in 2004, the trajectory dipped again, and it's been 1.5% a year since then. Okay? And this is during all this period of supposedly all of these changes you constantly hear about, the dominance of Silicon Valley, et cetera, et cetera. It's not showing up. It's hard to see the robots and anything else in the data. Okay. All right, so what do these facts mean about how robots are going to affect our jobs? Are they coming for our jobs or are they not? Silicon Valley and all that, what are they actually doing? Is it for real? And robots and productivity growth more generally as we look off into the future. So let me speak to those briefly. So first, the connection between robots and jobs. Well, given the slow productivity growth, what we can definitely reject is the notion that we're having sort of a slow recovery from the Great Depression because of the robots. We would have experienced unemployment drops more quickly if only the robots weren't here. Okay? That's just not true. If the robots were here, we would see it in the data. We're not seeing them in the data. They're not causing disemployment. There are other things that lagged out the recovery from the recession. On the other hand, longer run patterns, again, talking over a course of 1, 2, 3, 4 decades, it still could matter if they show up, but we'll come back to that. What does matter for the longer run patterns is something that kind of is evoked by the picture, both what happened in manufacturing and the hollowing out picture is, if you are a worker and you're going to be dealing with robots, you want to make sure you are a complement to technology and not a substitute for it. Okay? And that has been true throughout history. Whenever new technology has been invented, it is often substituted for labor, but at the same time, it has also created new jobs to run that technology. Okay? So you want to be able to position yourself. We want to create schools, training, and education that can position people more generally to be complements to technology rather than substitutes to it. What about Silicon Valley? Well, it's probably true that a fair amount of what they're saying is over-optimistic. They aren't going to change the world as much as they think. I think that's an equilibrium outcome, actually, in a world where you've got a lot of entrepreneurs. You need sort of like a pathological optimism to be an entrepreneur, I think, and so you're always going to tend to have people who are on average overstating the effect that they're going to have. Okay? And to that point, actually, for all the talk about technology and how things have changed. The U.S. has experienced over the last 30 years a secular decline in the rate of business formation. The number of new companies created as a share of all companies has been falling for 30 years. Did you know that? A lot of people don't know that. That's true even in tech industries, by the way. It grew for about a 6 or 7 year period in the mid-90s for tech industries, but since then it's fallen. And for all industries overall, it's been dropping for 30 years, and we do not know why. We don't know why firm creation has slowed. And so, but it's one more notion of, you know, be a tiny bit skeptical when you think about, when you hear about what the next technology is going to do and how it will revolutionize your world. Okay? That all said, of course, it doesn't mean nothing's going to change and we're stuck in 2015 for all eternity. Surely some things will emerge that have great effects, but again, I don't think the average claim out there is an accurate assessment of what's going to happen. And what about robots and productivity growth more generally? So what I would say now is rather than worrying about the robots coming to take our jobs, we need to worry about whether they're ever going to show up. And this productivity growth slowdown is a big deal. To go from 3% to 1.5%, which is about the fall we've seen over the last 10 years, that's, again, 1.5% of growth taken off the top every year. So that's 15, we are 15% poorer than we would have been had productivity growth not fallen. And by the way, that's an answer to the people who say, well, what's happened is that the technologies aren't showing up in the statistics. They're there. The benefits are there. They're just not in our GDP statistics. Okay, that's fine. The amount of statistics you say we're missing is $2.5 trillion, or $8,300 for every person in the United States. Okay? Maybe some of us might be willing to pay $8,300 to not go back to 2004 and to not have to have a flip phone instead of a smartphone and whatever changes have happened in that 10 years. But can we say that for everybody? Because that's what you have to say, oh, technology's continued to progress like it was before. It's just something happened where we can't measure it anymore. So there's a big missing gap there. And this is the concern that's been raised by what some people call the great stagnation hypothesis, that we've somehow run out of ideas. And rather than the robots taking over, we can't figure out how to make the robot. I actually think that, too, is overstated. So if you overlay productivity growth during the IT era, which is this solid line here, so from 1970 into the present day, 2013 anyway, if you overlay that with labor productivity growth from an earlier era where we saw diffusion of a general-purpose technology that revolutionized how production was done, in other words, the electric motor and internal combustion engine, they look amazingly similar. You have about 25 years. So if you think 1970 is analogous to 1890, and it is roughly about the same gap between the invention of the transistor and the start of this series and the invention of a commercial dynamo and the start of this series. You see, there's about 25 years where things aren't happening, where people are saying, look, I see computers everywhere, but not in the productivity statistics. Well, I see electric motors everywhere, but not in the productivity statistics. And then all of a sudden, things spike up for a decade, and then they mysteriously slow down again. And that happened in electrification, too. Now, we're at the end of that period for the electrification. So what happened in the electrification era afterwards? Things spiked up again. So technology seems to come in waves. Does this guarantee the next productivity revolution is around the corner for IT? No, but it does say that you might get more than one kick from a general purpose technology, so maybe it's coming. All right, so to wrap up, in the short run, we don't need to worry about the robots. In fact, we probably need more of them. We need productivity growth to speed up again. However, in the longer run, there are consequences. The medium run, decades long, there are consequences that we're going to have to deal with in a transition if technologies do really come along that displace a lot of workers. And that's going to be something that will be a difficult puzzle to solve. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. I guess listening to these very diverse presentations, some things have leapt out at me, which end up in really one very big question that I want to just level at everybody. So we've heard about how there are various forms of data technologies that can be used, often by repurposing detection systems to provide things like potential solutions to issues of overfishing, for example, by showing where the locations of vessels and fish grounds are using Google satellites. We've heard about how it's possible to use certain kinds of informatics to try to tailor investment decisions to almost the psychological predilections of particular customers, and how companies like Merrill Lynch are having to reckon with these systems now and design their own. We've heard about how in the field of music, new musical instruments, at least successful new musical instruments, are very rare. You know, maybe my children invent new musical instruments every 5 minutes, but the number of those that are going to end up being massive pop successes is probably very small. For a new technology really to take off, it has to incorporate society in it. And that's not a simple matter. It's not that society itself is something that is simply there to be appropriated and kind of stuffed into a box, such that one can then use a formula to come up with a successful technology. And what's being said there about musical instruments is surely true about many of the technologies that we deal with. You know, so we've heard about QWERTY keyboards. There are similar kinds of legacy technologies to do with things like automobiles, for example. And then finally, the problem of what's happened to all of the robots. You know, why is it that issues of productivity, the productivity growth seems to be much more laggardly than it ought to be, given the real concerns about technologically caused unemployment and the like, and de-skilling. Each of these ends in a certain way in a question, and it's this question that I want answered. And I want it answered partly because I'm aware that my own work and a lot of the work in science and technology studies gets to this same point and then stops. It gets to the point of identifying something like a problem, but nobody really has an answer to the problem. And the problem is simply, it's sort of a Karl Marx's problem. What do you do? Scott began by pointing to the issue of the use of Google satellites for fishery protection and said, well, maybe we're not comfortable with using these technologies and repurposing them in these kinds of ways because of the implications that exist for things like the development of surveillance systems and also that one would need to add the reality of a networked system where nothing is ever forgotten. So it's, you know, think of the no-fly list notoriously in the United States. If you ever get onto that list, I think it's the case that only one person has ever managed to get off it. And, for what it's worth, I hit this because I'm not a U.S. citizen, I'm a green card holder. Every single time I come through immigration at O'Hare or LAX or something, I get pulled aside and interviewed because back in about 1990, somebody mistyped a single character into a database, as a result of which it was a date. They mistyped a single character and a date, and it looked like I'd overstayed on a visa, and so every single time I go through, this has to be looked at and corrected, but it's never actually expunged. And this inability of the technology systems to forget anything creates a huge extra layer of issues of citizenship and responsibility and accountability for these kinds of domains. So my question is to each of the panelists in your domain, I put it in two ways. The broad question is what is to be done. The more specific one is what are the ingredients of good citizenship in a world that's increasingly defined by these kinds of technologies?
So. All right. I'm not going to be able to answer this question well, but I'm not sure what the solution is. I think the best hope we have is to not make the problem worse. And even that's not easy. So putting it in context of the things I sort of talked about, if there's going to be technologically driven unemployment, what do you do about the unemployed? People might say, well, you can have retraining programs and things like that, but we have tried those, and they don't really work very well. It's hard to teach an old dog new tricks, as people say. It's hard to take a 45-year-old displaced worker and retrain them for the job of the future for innumerable reasons. Does that mean you shouldn't try? I don't know, but we have some experience in that, and it's very difficult. What I would say is what you don't want to do is try to wish the problem away by removing the ability of employment changes to respond to technology. You don't want to say, well, you can't fire anybody. Okay? You can't, if you want to improve, if you want to upgrade your plant, you go ahead, but you're not allowed to fire anyone. Well, that will create more problems in the long run. Okay? You're going to be dealing with problems one way or the other, but you don't want to make it worse. So I think there's a set of those kind of don't make it worse responses. I don't know the magic solution, though. I do not. Sorry to say.
Yeah, we're getting all the hard questions here on the last panel. Yeah. It's appropriate. But, obviously, one thing is just talking about these issues is a good thing to get the problem on the agenda, but that's a typical academic response.
More academic. Yeah. That's what we need.
But, what...
That is a way to repurpose all the labor,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. One thing I'm been doing recently is thinking about repurposing technology. So we've been running these, this is all part of this much wider make-a-fair type thing that's in the air. We've been running do-it-yourself electronic workshops. And I've been amazed how many local kids and families have come to build synthesizers themselves and learn how to circuit bend toys to make interesting sounds. So somehow empowering people more in this relationship with technology. I mean, the whole thing today has been about trying to understand a bit better what these technological systems are and their impacts and how society gets into them. And so people actually getting hands-on with technology, for me, is a way of doing things and having fun with it as well. So that's.
I'll just add that in regards to, for example, the investment personality assessment that I mentioned earlier, so we've had 50,000 clients, which is roughly, it's a small amount, of our overall households. And we ran a study around how did the investment performance of those households differ from those clients of a sample set that did not go through that process. And that process basically meaning, a deep articulation of a client's goals that further maps to their priorities, which subsequently means their investments are tailored to that particular personality. And what we found is a significant lift in performance relative to a benchmark between those two groups. Now, the question is this. Once we identified the lift, which is the benefit of going through the whole purpose of my job, right, what's the level of responsibility to keep going? Because it's an extremely expensive proposition to keep these types of, to continuously go back to the population and continuously assess their investment personality and continuously adjust their portfolios accordingly. So the big thing now that we're working on is how do we operationalize this overwhelmingly subjective and qualitative conversation into something more technologically based without losing the benefit of having that qualitative conversation, right? And there's a huge responsibility there because once we crack the code on how to do better, then we have the responsibility to actually do it, right? Very similar to what Brett mentioned earlier on the data panel around once he understands who's going to commit the murder, what do you do with that data, right? How do you address it? So that's where I'm at in my head, if that makes sense.
I think it makes a lot of sense. Jumping right off of that, I think a lot of the challenge in the future of, as technology gets broader and more powerful and things like, I don't know if we have a solution to the no-fly list, but we might have ways to think about satellite monitoring. A lot of the question is about how we how we process complexity, how we really inform people of what exists and what's out there, both so they can take up opportunities, they can go and re-educate themselves to the extent that they can or make the right decisions as they're entering into high school and college, or, understand what their investment portfolios are, understand sort of how the types of decisions that you're thinking through as you're doing a qualitative assessment translate into technological solutions. And so one of the, in some sense, the answer is transparency, a component of an answer is transparency, but it's a very specific type of transparency, and it's one that we do not yet quite understand. We don't know how to make clear to people how all of these different complex interactions actually interact with their life and what they mean, at the practical level rather than at the sky empirical level.
Yeah. I do want to give people in the room a chance to contribute. But one of the things that technology does for us is that it allows for two-way communication at a distance in a way that gets beyond the one-to-many model of education that's existed for a millennium or more. And online I had a question from Kenny in Australia, of all places, which is a similarly large question. And it's simply, what is all this technology taking away from us all?
It's taking away from focus, right? And some I read four articles yesterday from wildly different sources, and I promise this is not a topic I actually focus on, pun not intended, but, you know, like mathematicians talking about how they have to, like, disconnect their computer from the internet in order to sit and work on math, or, you know, the one's tendency, and I'm as much of an addict as others, to, like, check information streams as they come in. You know, while I should be, like, you know, listening to a talk or preparing my remarks or something of the sort. One thing that as we're sort of constantly bombarded with information and new ways to get information is that it becomes all the more easy for us to, you know, solve small problems and not think about big ones, both in life, the universe, and everything.
In the employment market, it's taken away danger, actually. Jobs are much safer than they used to be, largely because of technology. Maybe you could argue it's taken away drudgery too, although it's added its own kind of drudgery. So I think the jury's out on that one. But it's taken away danger. I think that's fair.
I think it's a mixed picture in my field. Moments of where technology come along. You always think of technology as enabling. I mean, essentially tools to enable what humans do. That's how I think of technology. But then you get the standardization. So with the history of electronic music, you get moments of where it becomes like a glorified electric organ, this incredible instrument, the synthesizer. But then you get other periods when it opens up again, when it enables new sorts of things to be done. So it's not as straightforward, but there's certainly stuff being lost at the same time as new stuff coming along.
That's a very interesting question, and I'm going to answer from a different perspective. From an organizational standpoint at Merrill Lynch, I think the negative effect of the other technology, I think, would be the fact that we're never happy with where we are, right? And there's a certain quality of life element to that, right? So, for example, in our quest in behavioral finance, once we figure something out and we're able to actually benefit our clients from it, and subsequently our firm from it, right? Because we are responsible to stakeholders, right? And shareholders. Then we want more. And every code that we crack means we just want to crack more codes. And as a result, our technology spend as an organization is fourfold our closest competitor. But that's okay because our business as a result is tenfold. So, right? And again, that efficiency just keeps us hungrier for more and more. And sometimes where there's not even problems to fix, we're looking to fix something, right? And that just, you know, and that's counterproductive to the efficiency that's born out of the original technology. So we're working through it, but at some point in time, we just have to relax and enjoy what we've created, right? Easier said than done, though.
Thank you. So I want to see other questions from the floor, and please remember to say your name and affiliation if you have one.
Hi, my name is Barbara Wimsatt. I'm unaffiliated, but my question is, and this gets back a little bit to what Trevor Pierce Pinch said, and that is, you know, some things like when you speak about productivity, a lot of what's being produced is basically junk. And we don't need it, and it's actually degrading our planet at this point. So perhaps when we start producing more things that are like renewable energy and other things that are useful for the planet, that'll turn it around and we'll have more productivity. And I mean, if you take Uber, a recent Nation article said Uber is basically the Walmart of public transportation, and that it's been, you know, harmful to labor. Well, of course, you could look at it and say, well, this would push the taxi industry to be more efficient and more responsive. So that's the other side of it. And but I think that, you know, hopefully a lot of things will change that are unproductive towards new product.
I mean, the common is, I agree entirely. Things that basically what you're saying is that we need to have a more complex way of thinking about technology and society and the environment and all the other things, economic inequality in the world. And it's a very hard thing to do because we tend to think of technology as about these discrete artifacts rather than this much more complex picture I think people have tried to weave today. And I've just downloaded Uber. Now I'm starting to feel guilty. So apparently it's the only way of getting around here or out of here.
Okay, so go ahead.
Thank you. Well, a lot of today's discussion has been focused on the potential problems in terms of that could be brought to society in terms of advancement in technology, which some might call first world problems. I would like to ask about how could technology advancement be deployed and utilized in underdeveloped parts, not just of this country, but around the world, where technology literacy and accessibility is very low, and where parts they're not only missing out on this round of technological development, but might be several cycles behind in terms of advancement. Thank you.
Well, I guess I'll speak from the perspective of market design. Certain pieces of technology have enabled incredible amounts of market design in the developing world. And again, this is not done by economists, you know, sitting with with carefully controlled experiments, but rather, you know, cell phones as they've become widespread. You know, most of the developing world, at least to the best of my knowledge, is not using Samsung Galaxy Notes, but cell phones that the developed world stopped using a while ago. But they're still using them in ways that exceed the ways we used to use cell phones. Like, you can use them to take loans or to learn information about which markets have the highest prices. And so farmers who previously just always had to go to the closest market because they had no information suddenly have access to this incredible wealth of information about where they might be able to, you know, find the highest rates. And so I think technology has this is a platitude. Technology has a lot of power to enhance the developing economies. But in particular, it has the power to bring sort of, effective market-based solutions and access to marketplaces in a way that's faster than, countries that developed a century ago did.
Hi, this question is for Chad. Severson? My grandparents were pioneer homesteaders from North Dakota. My dad grew up on a farm in North Dakota. Right. So I come from this from a very practical, grounded basis. I'd like you to address, in terms of productivity, the peeling away of productivity gains from flatlining of wages in the mid-70s. I work in high tech, so I saw that blip in the 90s, and I also saw, I'm addressing the whole training thing about teaching an old dog new tricks. That would be a hard sell in Congress, where most of the people are over 60 years old and feel they're very vital.
Yeah.
Albeit the low ratings of Congress, but opinion poll. And then also, within that context, looking at the impact of massive flows of immigration into this country since, you could either say 1965 or the 86 amnesty, we know we've allowed in 17 million new people since 2000. So, and yet we've not created as many jobs as we've let people in. So I'd like you to, within that construct, address the issue of productivity, the flatlining of wages, for instance, the mid-70s, and the whole retraining thing. I have my own opinion on the training. I don't think it's a matter of people not getting retrained. It's the way that training programs worked. And Professor Orfield, who used to teach here now at UCLA or USC, he wrote about this back in the 80s, because I worked on the book, because I'm an alum. I worked on a book for him called JTPA, if you remember that. So anyway, I'll go.
Yeah, thank you. It's a big set of issues, but I'll try to summarize my thoughts on them. So first of all, what he's pointing out is, I talked about what was going on with productivity growth over this period. Well, it turns out wages, compensation had followed productivity growth for as long as data had lasted, until around, it's not clear when, sometime in the 1970s. And then productivity growth growth goes up, not as fast as it was in the golden era, but still goes up, where wages start going up at a much slower rate. And the two series diverged, and they've been diverging since then. And it's really another statement of the widening income inequality that we've seen, because productivity growth, output per worker, is another way to say average income, whereas the median income, which is going to be more in the labor compensation data, shows up as it's growing more slowly. Now, why is that happening? We're still working on that one. A lot of stuff has been proposed. You actually mentioned one in particular, immigration, and maybe there's some connection there. I'm not an expert in that literature. I think it's a fair summary to say that does not seem to be a big quantitative issue, that immigration is not the primary issue with slow wage growth on the bottom end of the wage scale. What else is going on? Well, it's what's true is, speaking of technology, not only is technology has done many things, but one thing it has done is it's created greater reward for skill than was there before. And if you take the same skill distribution but then change the technology in a way where the gradient of your wage relative to your skill goes up, you're going to get more income inequality. And so that does seem to be a fair amount of it. Now, what particular aspects of technology do that and so on and so forth, how that interacts with policy, those are still open questions. And we could have a whole conference on that one. I'll just leave it there and say that those are still open questions, but they're good ones.
I'm actually under orders to stop. Can we maybe have Bilsby standing there for a few minutes? Why don't we just have one more question from Bill, I think, and then we should cut it off.
You actually, in your response, raised the issue that I was particularly concerned about. That is, productivity may have slowed, but it's still going up, and wages have not. So I'll ask another one. What impact can technology have on our schools, and also maybe in identifying loci of early child deprivation, of the sort of work Jim Heckman has been doing on? Can technology do anything for us there?
Well, that's a hard one to end with. I'm not sure how it's interacted with our schools in terms of, one is how is education delivered? I don't think technology has had much to do with that at all. I mean, we here in the academy especially are often accused of using the same technology that was used 500 years ago, much less 5 years ago, to deliver what we deliver. Maybe that's not suboptimal. I don't know. But in terms of delivery, it hasn't changed much. I think the curriculum probably hasn't been as responsive to the change in technology as it could be. And I'm talking about from birth on up curriculum, including the early childhood years. In just one example, and this is something I harp on a little bit, we still teach trigonometry all over the place, but no statistics hardly in high school. And it just seems to me, if you're going to be an engineer, okay, trig is good, but if you're going to be anybody but an engineer and a citizen, I'd rather you learn statistics than trigonometry. But I don't see that happening in many places. And you all could probably come up with other examples. So I think that sector is kind of famously slow at adjusting, and maybe that's good for some reasons, but I think that's an issue here in terms of its interface with technology.